This week, an all-too-familiar winter tragedy. An Iowa teenager killed in a snowmobile accident. This hour, the greatest hazards facing snowmobilers. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, we'll get an update about the Iowa juvenile home being ordered to reopen. We'll hear about tomorrow's National Cyber Defense Competition at Iowa State University. Also, research on how well global weather forecasting models work. And a conversation with sports columnist Bryce Miller from the Des Moines Register, who's covering the Winter Olympics in Russia. First, this news. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A handful of items, short conversations to match for this hour coming up later in the hour. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with a conversation I had with Bryce Miller, Des Moines Register sports columnist. He's at the Olympics in Russia. We'll get the view from Bryce Miller in just a moment. Also from neighboring Ukraine, you probably heard of that embarrassing conversation between a State Department official and a U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, posted on YouTube, the news. We'll get Jim McCormick's take on that, the situation in Ukraine. And also, we'll talk about snowmobile safety here in the winter, because another tragedy has happened. A teen was killed in Iowa in a snowmobile crash, and we'll talk about what hazards are out there if you are snowmobiling. But first, this week, Democrats in the Iowa Senate continued work on a bill to reopen the Iowa juvenile home in Toledo, even though a court case over the issue is not resolved. Governor Terry Branstad ordered the home closed after reports of abuse of girls there. But a district court judge this week ruled that the governor had overstepped his authority. Joining me now to explain this story and the latest developments, Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So tell us more about the latest developments this week.
Well, the district court judge came down, as you said, in favor of the Democrats and the head of the Public Employees Union who had sued over the closing. They had made the argument in their case that the governor had exceeded his authority, that the legislature had passed a budget for the home, and so the governor had no right to close the home, and essentially the district court judge agreed.
Mm-hmm. What was the governor then arguing?
Well, his response to that and his statement all along is that as the chief executive, he has ultimate responsibility for care of the girls there, and he says that they can be better cared for in other facilities.
Take us back a little bit and remind us how this whole story started.
Well, at the Disability Rights Iowa, this is an advocacy group, began sort of really not even knowing what they were going to find. They had just made a decision to step up their oversight of facilities like that facility in Toledo. And they found instances of long-term isolation of girls at the home. And that caused quite an outcry. And there's been a lot of discussion of it, continues to be a lot of discussion of it at the State House.
The governor says this appeal, an appeal to the ruling is under review. So we will hear about that in the coming days. What has happened in the meantime with the children, the girls who were there?
Well, they've all been placed in alternate facilities, some public, some private, one or two in detention pending other opportunities. And the Department of Human Services has made clear to point out that all of these appointments were court approved.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about the political implications of this story, of the news?
Well, Governor Branstad's running for reelection, and Senator Jack Hatch, a Democrat in the Iowa Senate, is his likely opponent. And so, it depends on how this is settled between now and November. But the governor can make the case that, you know, the welfare of those girls is the most important thing. And so he stepped in and closed down the home The argument on the other side is that without a training facility for girls, some of those girls might end up in adult court. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how those two arguments play out. But I think more important is where we're at this come November.
Okay. Thank you, Iowa Public Radio correspondent Joyce Russell. Thanks for the update.
Okay.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition, and we have to include this one, of course, this week. The 2014 Winter Olympics commencing tonight with the opening ceremonies, and we have on the line Bryce Miller, who is the Des Moines Register sports columnist. He is in Sochi reporting on the Winter Olympics. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. When did you arrive?
A couple of days ago. The days and the hours start to become a bit of a haze once you get on the ground 10 time zones ahead and away. And so been here a few days and been down in Sochi, and now I've been up in the mountains a little bit to check out some of those venues, but just getting our feet under us.
Mm-hmm. What's the feeling like as more athletes and fans have arrived over the last couple of days?
I'm not sure it's clear what the fan turnout's going to be. I think, you know, as the opening ceremony unfolds and then moving ahead, you'll get a better sense of how many people actually show up. There's the safety and security concerns, and travel is a bit, you know, challenging, and for some people more challenging than they want to take on. So the athletes are here. The venues look great. What kind of Olympics unfold and who gets to see it? That's one of the questions we'll find out later.
Mm-hmm. What are the other questions that you will be looking at as a columnist reporting from Sochi?
Well, you know, it's something that published today in the Register looked at kind of an overview of the beginning of an Olympics that started for the first time before the opening ceremony. Three sports began before the opening ceremony even happened. That's never been the case at a Winter Olympics. So many questions, too, that I looked at that aren't sport-related at all. You know, Russia's anti-gay laws, concerns about safety and security, all the way down to, you know, Edward Snowden has been given asylum in Russia after being an intelligence whistleblower. None of these are about skiing or ski jumping or snowboarding. It just feels like an Olympics that has so many peripheral questions.
Let's talk a little bit about security. Having been on the ground there for a couple of days, do you sense a lot of security coming into the Sochi, then up in the mountains?
Yeah, this is my sixth Olympics with the Register and the USA Today groups. We're in the same company, and I think there's little doubt that this is probably the most comprehensive layered security net that at least I've seen at those Olympics. A lot more scanning, checking credentials, lots of metal detectors, lots of monitored fence areas, all the way down to things like, you know, we were driving a bus through a mountain venue, and you kind of just tucked away in a little portion of the woods on the left was like a missile battery that, you know, was kind of moving back and forth. I'm sure they have radar where they're, you know, they've considered every scenario, even in an up to things that are as scary and chilling as that. But yeah, there's no doubt that safety and security is the biggest priority of these Olympics heading into it.
You mentioned the controversies connected with these Olympics that are not necessarily of a sporting slant. The anti-gay laws that Russia has, any evidence of that? Any athletes talking about that?
You know, I think the media has asked some athletes, and there's been some reaction. You know, in other countries, there's a lot of backlash and concern and debate about those laws in Russia. But, you know, the most visible or prominent kind of piece of that story, I think, is, you know, for the first time in years and years and years and years, the U.S. delegation isn't sending somebody from either, you know, the first family or, you know, somebody prominently in an administration, and we're sending openly gay athletes. And that's one of the things. And Billie Jean King, you know, the tennis star, was going to be one of those athletes and had to back out. But that was a signal that, you know, to so many around the world that President Obama was making a statement directly to President Putin in Russia that, without saying it out loud, this is what we think about anti-gay laws in Russia, and we want to make a kind of visible statement about it in this way.
You visited the facilities in Sochi down in the valley?
Yeah, down by the coast, just it borders the Black Sea, and it's such a strange, you know, this place is, we had a Russian interpreter who helped us with some stories, and she called it, and I thought it was great, Russian California, because there are palm trees down by the coast, and you look behind them, and you see snow-capped mountains in the background. It's a little bit of everything in this kind of southwest corner of Russia.
Mm-hmm. So have you been into some of the facilities where they would have, for instance, figure skating, speed skating?
Yeah. I did a story or two out of the figure skating venue, and the way the Olympic Park's situated, a lot of those venues are in a big circle, a hub, and figure skating's right next to the curling venue, which is right next to the hockey facility. The opening ceremony is in that same grouping as well at the stadium, and so there's that cluster. They call it the coastal cluster. And then there, you know, all the alpine-type events and snowboarding, they're up in the mountains.
Now, speaking of the mountains, Sean White, we heard, dropped out of slopestyle. This is a new type of competition, very demanding. Is there a lot of chatter about that, or is it just because he's an American that we're getting a lot of chatter when it's really not being talked about much at Sochi?
You know, I think it's both. He's iconic beyond the U.S. competitors and fans, because I think other countries involved in those sports know kind of both him as a trailblazer and him as somebody who would contend without a doubt for a medal. So him moving out of slopestyle snowboard, you know, on one hand, I understand his point that he's trying to really focus on another event that would give him a chance to be the first American to win win gold three times in that event. So in that sense, you understand what he's trying to do. He's narrowing his focus and trying to avoid injury and all those things. But the rest of the world says, well, there's an opening for another medal in slopestyle.
Right.
So he's certainly one of the big storylines.
Right, and because he dropped out so late, the U.S. will not be able to fill his slot, I understand.
I believe that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Have you spoken with any athletes, getting their impressions at all yet, or are you able to get in contact with them yet?
Yeah, part of that Gannett USA Today group that I'm with, talked to the coach of the U.S. cross country skiing team today to do a feature on him for a Boise TV station that's in our network. Talked to some figure skaters, Jeremy Abbott, who is, you know, the first American in figure skating to compete in the new team competition for people in Michigan that have connections to him there that are Gannett newspapers. So it's been kind of a hometown story, work schedule early on. And then, once it settles in, there are a couple of, prominent Iowa connections. Obviously, Lola Jones, the Des Moines native, will be in bobsled a little farther down the road. And then Drake University claims the oldest American at this Olympics, 46-year-old Ann Swisshelm, who's on the U.S. curling team.
Mm-hmm. Opening ceremonies, as I mentioned, tonight. All the athletics get underway in earnest. For you, Bryce Miller, having reported on sports for many years, now a columnist with the Des Moines Register, and having reported on many Olympics, what is a personal highlight or highlights you're looking forward to?
Well, you mentioned it. One of the thrills of almost every Olympics I've been involved in is seeing, in person the opening ceremony. The one that blew me and so many people away was, in Beijing, China in 2008. The sound and the spectacle and the visual kind of everything involved basically at every level of that opening ceremonies was kind of a standard for any of those moving ahead. There's always surprises. They never let information out about what it's going to be. A lot of people speculate on who's going to be the person who lights the Olympic torch in the park. It's usually somebody prominent or famous from that country. So it's just one of those moments that to see it and hear it and feel it in person, it's pretty special.
Mm-hmm. Bryce Miller, how can people follow your reporting while you're in Sochi?
Well, a couple of ways. Obviously in the Des Moines Register, but we have a dedicated page, DesMoinesRegister.com/Sochi. So that's an easy one to remember. A lot of our work there, including video clips. I did a couple in the last few days, a tour of my room at the Olympics, since that was such a hot topic, see what one of these places looks like. Did something from a mountain venue to give a sense of what that looks like, too. So in the paper on that website and on Twitter, I'm @Bryce_A_Miller. So I'll be tweeting from the games, too, as we move ahead. And so any of those ways.
Okay. Bryce Miller, how is your room, by the way?
It's, you know, of all the horror stories we heard about, you know, brown tap water and, you know, rooms with no doors and just the, you know, all the stories that kind of came out. The worst thing in my room is it doesn't have a shower curtain. And, you know, for some reason, that's a lot of rooms here. I don't know if there's a black market on shower curtains in Russia and you can't get your hands on one. But I guarantee if that's the worst thing that happens to me at this Olympics, I'll be pretty happy on the plane ride home.
Des Moines Register sports columnist Bryce Miller. We'll hope to check in with you again. Enjoy the opening ceremonies and coverage.
All right, thanks.
While we're in the area, let's stay in Asia, what, 10 time zones away from Iowa. This week, a conversation between a State Department official and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine was posted on YouTube. It revealed an embarrassing exchange on U.S. strategy for a political transition in that country, including a crude American swipe at the European Union. Joining us a few minutes to talk about this, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Let's listen to one of the excerpts from this, and then we'll talk about it. This is Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland weighing in on the makeup of the next Ukrainian government.
He's now gotten both Sari and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Sari could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is...
Okay, that's a little bit of that. Evidently, our State Department did watch The Sopranos when it was on, Jim McCormick. What is in particular embarrassing about the excerpts? We heard just one of them about what was revealed this week.
Well, it's probably impolitic to use that kind of language, and particularly with you know, our close ally of the European Union. I guess I was a little bit surprised because, of course, Victoria Nuland was, for the longest time, was a State Department spokesperson. She's served in other posts as an ambassador to NATO previously. So obviously she was really caught off guard. I think the other sort of larger picture of this is, what does it tell us about the security of our conversations? And, you know, there's been a lot about NSA spying on other countries. It looks like the United States has also experienced a little bit of that. So I think there are some diplomatic kind of impact here, but there's also this larger question about the security of our communications here.
Do we know who leaked this?
Well, you know, the Russians are getting credit for it or blame, one of the two here. And, you know, that even the State Department spokesperson back in Washington seems to think that this was one of the, you know, crude kind of actions on the part of Russia here.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly it does raise this question about the security of our communications. I mean, this was a telephone conversation. I don't know if it was over a secure line or not. You would expect it would be, but it obviously wasn't very secure.
If the Russians did leak this, how does it play into their game plan concerning neighboring Ukraine, the unrest there?
Well, I think there's a couple. First of all, it shows you the obviously continued interest in Russia with regard to Ukraine, and do not want Ukraine to move towards the West. I mean, that's already been in turmoil since last November when the Ukrainian government rejected this EU plan and tilted towards Russia here. But I also think that the other impact, of course, immediately, and I just noted that the German chancellor has come out and condemned this kind of statement, saying that it's totally unacceptable. It does cause some slight fissures, it seems to me. I mean, some of this reaction by the Europeans is going to be for domestic consumption, but it does cause some, you know, fissure in the American-European relations in terms of trying to get a settlement or try to have an impact on the settlement within Ukraine. I mean, the the reference, of course, that the Assistant Secretary made was that, you know, the Europeans are kind of dragging their feet on trying to get a transformation within Ukraine and have not been really very supportive of the American effort to impose sort of travel restrictions on particular individuals and impose other kind of sanctions on Ukraine here, because the European view is that would be counterproductive for this larger goal. Maybe further divide the politics of Ukraine, and the Americans are pressing, at least over the last week or so, for getting some kind of a settlement. But the longer point about this too is that even though this conversation was leaked and it talks about the Americans trying to work for a settlement, that plan fell through, and we're sort of back to square one here.
Mm-hmm. So this transformation hangs in the balance. Do we know what direction generally it is going into and what's going to happen? No.
Well, we do not. I mean, I think the Ukrainian president, I mean, actually the proposed two members that would join the sort of the government as underlings to the current president, you know, sort of the opposition group joining together, have now backed out, even though that's part of the conversation that this would be, Americans were kind of nudging at least to get one of these former economic minister back in the government that was more Western oriented than Yanukovych, the president who obviously looks towards Moscow here.
Mm-hmm.
And that has fallen through, and we're that's why I say we're sort of back to square one in terms of getting a settlement there.
Ominously, we heard on Thursday a senior Kremlin aide accusing the U.S. of arming Ukrainian rebels and warned that Russia could intervene to maintain the security of its neighbor. A military intervention? Possibility?
Well, you know, in eastern Ukraine, of course, they're mostly Russian-speaking, and obviously it was an area that, Russia had dominated here. I think that that's a lot of bluster rather than anything else. Ukraine is so pivotal for the West. I mean, I always tell my class to look at a map, to look at where Ukraine is. It's been called this kind of pivot state because it could really tip the balance. I mean, the larger framework for American policy, of course, is to bring all of these European countries, toward the westward, and including Russia, too. And so I think Ukraine is really very pivotal. And I don't think the Americans or the EU would really stand for any kind of action by the Russians.
Mm-hmm. We have about 30 seconds left, but what pivotal things will you be looking for in the development of this story, the unrest in Ukraine?
I think one of the things that could come out of this, and hopefully from a Western point of view, is that we really get a united position. I mean, this might in some ways bolster the EU-US relationship, after the niceties. I know the Assistant Secretary has apologized. And so there might be a stronger stance, and maybe there actually would be some sanctions, because there's still, of course, these opposition groups that are in the square in Kiev and so on. So I think that's one of the hopeful signs that might come out of this.
Jim McCormick, will certainly be talking to you in depth at a later date about the situation in Ukraine. Thank you for this update.
Thank you very much.
Professor and Chair of Political Science at Iowa State University. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Still to come after a short break, we'll talk about the national, just talking about cyber security and leaks. National Cyber Defense Competition taking place tomorrow at Iowa State University. Also, the hazards to snowmobilers in Iowa. You'll want to stay tuned for that. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. A NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come a little bit later, we'll hear about hazards to snowmobilers in light of a tragic death, a snowmobile accident in western Iowa. Also, research on global weather forecasting to come. But first, the news recently about stolen credit cards and debit card numbers, perhaps yours was one of the numbers that was hacked into, stolen, from the Target incident. But it was a reminder that we all need to be concerned about cybersecurity. So tomorrow's National Cyber Defense Competition at Iowa State University is a lot more than an academic exercise. And during tomorrow's competition, teams of students from Iowa State and other universities will test their ability to fight off hackers. Joining me now, one of the competition's organizers, Doug Jacobson, University Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Iowa State University. Professor Jacobson, Doug, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
I understand the contest is designed to challenge experienced cyber defense teams. How will it do that?
Yeah, well, these teams have been given about 3 weeks to build their own defensive environment based on a story, just a scenario. And come Saturday morning, the red team, which consists of professional hackers, people who work for companies doing testing of security systems, they'll come in and start trying to break into the students' computer systems.
So what do the students know beforehand? You said a scenario. What can you outline the scenario they were given?
Basically, it's a little story. So usually it focuses around you're an IT person for an organization, and you need to build an environment that supports web and supports remote access and email. And the stories really mimic the kind of things that students or professionals would find when they're setting up or trying to protect a business. And the reason we give them a story like that is that lets them have the creativity to try to build their own defenses. There's numerous ways to protect computers, and as opposed to some competitions out there, students just walk into a pre-built network and they have to defend it. In our situation, they not only have to defend the network, but they have to build it ahead of time.
I understand the public can attend. What will people actually see? It's free, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the public is welcome to come. You see a big room full of students sitting at keyboards. We encourage the public to actually go and interact with the students. We like the fact that this is kind of a noisy and somewhat chaotic environment, which again mimics what happens in real life. Most people don't have the luxury of locking themselves in a room and having no outside distractions. We also encourage, there's ways that the public can participate. We have what we call the green team, which are users. So not only do the defenders have to protect the system has to be usable. So we have these green team members that come in and, play with email and play with the website and try things. So the students are judged on not only things being secure, but things being usable.
It's interesting. You have actually veterans from outside, not non-students, who are challenged to come in and break through to hack into these systems. Is it generally pretty easy pickings for them to get in, or do they find it, the people coming in from outside in the workforce, a rather difficult challenge?
Well, And that's part of what we try to do in this game. The game is somewhat rigged because it's only an 8-hour time frame in which the students are defending. So there are some things that are broken, vulnerable, and so the students have to react to those. So the red team has some ways to get in. Again, given the short nature, but it's still challenging for them. The big challenge is that everybody's different.
Right. Now, I imagine, do you have some standout? We have about 30 seconds left, but do you have some standouts, some people, if these people from outside are looking and saying, hey, they are really good, does that get something that's possibly for a resume?
Oh, yes. Some of our red team, the attackers come here with the purpose of looking for the top students to hire.
Okay. Doug Jacobson, before we go, tell us how we can find out more if people want to attend.
They can go to our website, www.iac.iastate.edu, and there's a link on that website which talks about the competition.
The National Cyber Defense Competition at Iowa State University tomorrow, Saturday. Doug Jacobson, University Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at ISU. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Wednesday, a 13-year-old boy was killed in a snowmobile crash southwest of the small Iowa town of Fonda. The community of Fonda is just northwest of Dodge. Joining us to talk about this accident, this tragedy, and snowmobile safety, David Downing is the Off-Highway Vehicles Program Manager for the Iowa DNR. Hi, David.
Hello.
An all-too-familiar tragedy. What can you tell us about how it happened?
Well, it's my understanding that the operator was with some other snowmobilers and a person on an ATV and were riding up a creek area. And there happened to be a rope suspended between two bridge pillars, and the other folks ducked. He did not, and caught him, and obviously died of his injuries.
Mm-hmm. Do we? I know this is under investigation by the DNR. Do we know why this rope was suspended between the two bridge pillars?
Not at this time. It's an ongoing investigation, and one of the things they want to make sure they do due diligence in this case, not just for the young man, but his family and friends and so forth, to make sure that they know why the rope was there, how long it's been there, if they've operated in the area before, and just to make sure that they get a good grasp on what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. This is an all-too-familiar scenario, I think, driving a snowmobile, is it not? Is that a chief threat to a snowmobiler? You're going off-road. You don't necessarily know what people have put out in these areas where there are normally not any vehicles, right?
It is. It's one of those things. You know, we have over 8,000 miles of designated snowmobile trails in the state, and those trails are groomed and they're marked. You know, so you know where the hazards are, and that's why we always recommend that folks stay on those trails. However, you know, depending on where you are, you may be riding on your farm or adjacent landowner, or ditch riding, which is perfectly legal. But you also have to understand, too, that often during the year, those landowners make changes to the property. They may put up a cable between a gate. They may have a suspension wire coming down off of a corner post, and those types of hazards are unmarked. And unfortunately, if you're not familiar with that area, it just takes, you know, one moment, and you're looking at snow, and so things don't always show up, particularly if those objects have collected snow. And obviously, striking any of those fixed objects is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. What can you do to mitigate, to avoid such hazards that may be out there? What I know, David, you are a snowmobiler, right?
I am, and I also, you know, this hits home because I also have a son who's now 20, but at 13 he was operating just like this young man, out having fun with his friends, and so it really strikes home as a parent. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I always remind my son that when you're riding, even in a field that's, you know, owned by his grandfather, my dad may have put something up in that field that we aren't aware of during the year, and you always have a hazard, so you got to go slow at first, make sure of the area, your surroundings, particularly before you crack the throttle and have a little fun like a lot of young folks do.
All right. What are some of the other primary risks that snowmobilers face that they should keep in mind in these winter months, the primary causes of injuries and fatalities?
Most of them involve striking a fixed object. Whether it be a culvert, post, you know, something that's hidden in the snow. And again, that's the reason to stay on those designated trails when possible. If you're operating on the ice, you have to be extremely careful. On lakes, you have ice heaves, and those are particularly dangerous. Also, areas where you have a thawing of the ice from underneath, from currents or springs. So if you're operating on the ice, you have to be very careful. You just can't see things when you're operating. If you're on a lake, for instance, you want to make a run, make sure that first pass is a low speed, very cautious before you, again, get on the throttle and accelerate. Make sure of where you're at. River riding is very popular in this state. Thousands of miles of rivers you can ride on, public ice. But the biggest hazard there are sticks. Sticks collect snow. They stick up out of the ice. And when you ride by, what doesn't hit the sled comes up, and it'll catch an arm or a leg or a side and can prove fatal. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important thing. Ride with a group. So if you have a mechanical issue when it's very cold like this, or there's an incident, you have somebody to get help, there to render aid. And obviously wear the apparel. And in this case, he was wearing a helmet. But, you know, obviously you catch something under that helmet, the neck area, you're very vulnerable. But have on the right apparel and know your surroundings.
You mentioned frozen lakes and rivers and ice heaves. What is an ice heave?
It's the expansion and contraction under the ice and actually causes the ice to buckle. And they're hard to see. And we've had a number of injuries in the past where you'll be riding along, and usually at great speed because it's super smooth, it's fun to ride. And all of a sudden, you see something too fast, you're not able to stop because, again, it's white. It blends in with the surrounding and the horizon. And when you hit that, it's just like you might as well be going off a ramp. And so that causes a number of injuries each year, particularly on the lakes.
And again, make that first pass. If it's fresh snow, make that first pass in your group, slowly, cautiously looking around for all possible hazards.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Particularly at night. Night's a big thing because, you know, the snowmobile technology, just like cars, you know, it's come a long ways in terms of handling. The snowmobiles handle, they're mechanically sound. You can see further, but they're also, you get these four-stroke turbos, you know, 200-horse sleds where they can run over 100 miles an hour. So it's always tempting to get out there and accelerate to a high rate of speed. And particularly at night, that's a very dangerous thing because you just can't get stopped in time when you do see something.
I heard something earlier today. I don't know if it's true that in eastern Iowa, the Coralville Reservoir, that you can have ice freeze and then actually the water level below the however many inches of frozen ice drop, and that makes it an especially hazardous area.
It is, you know, and we have those on any of the major, like the reservoirs, Rathbun, Red Rock, places like that. They're great. They're fun to ride, but you have to be extremely careful. Water levels, fluctuation, changes the ice, and also the springs where the water comes in. At Clear Lake, you have the aeration for the fishery. And every year we drop people through the ice up there, either in cars or snowmobiles or ATVs, because they're not paying attention to those markings on those aeration areas.
Mm-hmm. Is it clearly marked? Are there signs put out on lakes that are unsafe for this reason?
For up there where the aeration is, yes. But a lot of times what we always tell people is there's no such thing as safe ice. And there just isn't. You have to be very, very careful. Be smart. In a snowmobile, if you're moving and you're not stopped, you know, you could pass over open water and you could stay up. It's when you go into something and you let off the throttle or you stop in those particular areas, you can be at hazard. And again, know your area, particularly with rivers. You know, make sure you're riding with somebody from the area. There are 60 snowmobile clubs across the state. They have rides all the time. And if you're in that area, ride with a club member. They're familiar with that trail system. They're also familiar with, particularly if you're riding the rivers or the lakes. So the local knowledge is very important that you ride with somebody you trust.
David Downing, thank you so much for these words of caution in the wake of this tragedy, a 13-year-old boy dying in a snowmobile crash from the small Iowa community of Fonda. David Downing, the Off-Road Vehicles Program Manager for the Iowa DNR. Thanks, David.
You bet.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of our program. We look back at, a handful of news events this week and get some conversations going about them. Back in September of last year, Boulder, Colorado, if you remember, Boulder, Colorado and the surrounding areas experienced severe flooding and some heavy rain, resulting in fatalities, the loss of homes and businesses, and the declaration of a major disaster, in fact. Now, after the storms had subsided, two University of Iowa researchers decided to examine how well some of the leading global forecasting models had done in predicting this extreme rainfall that caused the severe flooding. The results were published in the December 2013 issue of the journal Geophysical Research Letters, and it indicated that these forecasting models generally performed well, but also left some room for improvement. Joining me now, one of the researchers involved, David Lavers, postdoctoral research scholar at IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. David Lavers, welcome to you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Ben, too.
Explain what you and your co-author, Gabriella Villarini, set out to do here.
Well, the main thing is after the large floods that had occurred in Boulder, we decided to have a look at the latest weather prediction models to see how well did they forecast or capture the extreme rainfall that occurred during the Boulder floods.
Mm-hmm. How many models were you taking into account here?
So we looked at 8 different models and a multi-model, as they call it. So we look at an average of those 8 models together. Mm-hmm. Just to get an idea of what the spread is like in the models, if some models do better than others, just mm-hmm. to give you a better idea of the uncertainty of the event.
Mm-hmm. And I understand your findings were sort of a mixed bag. Tell us about it.
They were. So to start positively, which I think is a good place to start, these models certainly gave an indication of a significant period of rain that was coming up, that Boulder was to experience. The problems with them, firstly, they didn't predict as much rainfall as that occurred in the real observations, in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first thing. The one thing we must say on it, we used I don't want to get technical here, but a coarse model output. So there are different resolutions of models. Some of them will be, say, at a 50-kilometer by 50-kilometer resolution, so 30 miles by 30 miles. Some will be much finer, so they'll give you output at 5 miles by 5 miles, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But we use quite a coarse output. So that's one reason in the Rocky Mountains why we didn't possibly capture the extremeness of the event. But firstly, they definitely gave you a sign of extreme rainfall that was coming.
Now, when you say complicated, you do mean complicated, because when we describe weather patterns and all the data, can you give us an idea that in terms that we can understand how much data is involved in one of these predicting models?
So there's a huge amount of data involved. You're exactly right. So what they're doing is they produce a best state of the atmosphere, a best analysis, if you like. So say at midday today in Iowa, there'll be a best state of the atmosphere, what the temperatures are, what the wind patterns are, the pressure. And they'll then go forward in time solving these equations. And then when they get to the next time step in the model, they can assimilate. That's what they call this. So they bring in observations of data, and they'll be from satellite, from, if it wasn't in Iowa, it would be from, say, ships, aircraft, to try and bring the model back to reality, if you like, because the model has got its own climate, it's got its own climatology, and you need to bring it back to the observed world. It'll be very close to it, but you need to bring it back. And the amount of data that is brought into these models is truly astonishing. It's an enormous amount of data, and the computing power necessary to generate these forecasts, well, it is quite phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Yeah. Tell us, what are the implications of your findings here? How can they be used by other predictors of weather, climatologists?
Well, the first thing we wanted to do is just to see what these models could do. And it's really, as you go towards the future, could you use these models at a reasonably coarse resolution to give early warning for a extreme event like this in the future? Mm-hmm. So that's really where we were going with it.
And the answer to that question is, at some point in the future, we will be able to predict that?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? That's the thing. Would you be able to predict it? The models are always getting better. This is the one thing to think about. So with increasing computer power, with increasing knowledge of the atmospheric processes, we are capturing and modeling these small-scale processes even better. Now, I keep saying the word complicated, but it's very complicated in areas like the Rocky Mountains, where you've got such a varying landscape. But with future time, they are projected to get better. There's no doubt about that. Over the last 30 years, the increase in skill in weather forecast is certainly increasing rapidly, and that should improve into the future as well.
David Lavers, I hear that in your accent that you're not a native of these shores, but perhaps you know our most famous weather predictor in the United States, forecasting what's in store for us. Here he is on February 2nd, talking through an interpreter about what the next few months have in store for us. Let's listen.
A Super Bowl winner, I will not predict, but my weather forecast you cannot contradict. Why, that's not a football, but my shadow I see. It's 6 more weeks of winter. It must be!
Of course, that's Groundhog Punxsutawney Phil on February 2nd.
Well,
you're aware of Punxsutawney Phil.
Well, He's got a very nice accent, hasn't he? He really does. I only thought Mr. Ed could talk.
Well, that was his interpreter. He can't be bothered to learn speech.
I don't blame him.
so do you? You know, I realize your research is in a completely different area, but what can you say about the rest of our winter? Do you agree with Punxsutawney, Phil? Six more weeks of winter. It sure seems like it with the hard freezes we've been having.
Well, it certainly does. I couldn't comment on what's going to happen over the next 6 weeks or the rest of winter. I certainly know it's looking cold in the Midwest for the next week, I believe, and then there seems to be a bit of a signal of it warming up slightly, but I have to be honest with you, Ben, I've not looked further ahead into the future, but hopefully the groundhog will be wrong.
It's been
a brutal winter so far, I have to be honest, from where I'm from, we don't get weather quite as extreme as this.
You're from Britain?
I'm from Britain, that's right, it's certainly not as cold. It's been very wet there at the moment. We're having terrible floods in England, or in Britain in general, but the weather's never as cold as this. I don't know if I could ever moan about the damp and the rain again, although it's beautiful and bright here. It's a lovely place, but the weather is pretty cold.
All right.
But it's a great place.
Thank you. David Lavers, postdoctoral research scholar at IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. Thank you, David, for sharing your research with us today. And that is true. Even though it's cold, you do have to look on the bright side of life with the sun.
You too. Thanks a lot, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Eyes always look on the bright side of life. Come on.
And we're wishing you a bright, sunny and warm weekend despite the icy weather with a forecast of snow. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Help today from John Pemble as well. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Enjoy it. It's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death.